Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Hey, everybody. I got a great one today. You know, for a change. Finally, a guest with something to say. Michael Harriott is the senior writer for TheRoot.com, the largest black online newspaper. You should check out TheRoot.com, especially if you're white or black or Asian Pacific Islander or Latino, Latina, Latinx, I'm not sure, or like me, Jewish. If you're all of those, you should really have your own online newspaper. And then one of the things I like about Michael is that he writes, acerbically about race, politics, and culture. And I like acerbic. And I've asked myself, if I were a black writer journalist, what would my attitude be? I'd be acerbic, right? But after I just started talking with Michael, I realized that that's kind of a racist thing to ask myself, a racist, that just asking that question presumes that I have weird assumptions about what it means to be black. So I decided just to listen to Michael and ask him stuff. And I learned a lot and really enjoyed this one, you know, for a change. By the way, I have a big announcement. I'm going on tour, not with the podcast, although I'd like to do that at some point, but I'll be doing a 15-city tour. It's the only former senator currently on tour. I was doing this right before COVID, Portland, Seattle, Boston, New Haven. My last show was in South Orange, New Jersey, and that's when we had to stop. As a matter of fact, one of the ushers there had a cough. So I had to quarantine with the audience there for a month. Speaking of which, Andy Slavitt will be joining me on the podcast in a couple weeks to talk about all that with his terrific new book, Pandemic. And holy mackerel, it's a pretty searing indictment of the Trump team's response. But you kind of probably knew that. Anyway, I'll be starting the tour in mid-September. It's kind of an evening with Al Franken, and it's comedy. You'll hear some inside stories about the U.S. Senate, an impression, or two, or three, and political satire and commentary. Thanks, Bernie. All tickets are available right now at alfranken.com. I really hope to see you there, and I can't tell you how much fun I have doing it, and I just can't wait to get out there. This is all part of getting back to normal. Speaking of which, I know you're vaccinated, but there's been all this anti-vaccination propaganda coming from Fox News, and Tucker Carlson did a story last night. He said that a 46-year-old Kearney, Nebraska man got vaccinated at 1:53 p.m. and was dead exactly 12 hours later. Turns out his car was hit by a train. So vaccinate an anti-vaxxer today, all right? It may be illegal, but it could save lives. All right, we have Michael Harriott. You're going to get a lot out of this one. You know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, Let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
I want to start off by asking you, did you watch Biden's speech to the joint sessions, and then did you watch Tim Scott's response?
Yes, I watched both of them, and I thought, you know, Biden, he gave a presidential speech. You know, one of the things that we forget about presidents and that the job of the president is that it is a job that really doesn't have as much power as we give it credit for having. You know, we think the president can manifest something in his mind and make it come true. And that's kind of not how it works. But I thought it was a decent speech. And I also saw Tim Scott's speech. I am actually from South Carolina. So, you know, I am familiar with Tim Scott. My mother lives probably 10, 15 minutes from Tim Scott's, from where Tim Scott grew up in North Charleston. My mother lives in a little town right outside of North Charleston called Monk's Corner. So I am familiar with him. And I thought, you know, that part where he said America is not a racist country was asinine. But I think, you know, one of the ways I explain it is that there is this very confined definition that a lot of people have of racism that allows them to believe that America is not a racist country. So for a lot of people, racism has to be intentional and malicious. And so regardless of the outcome, if they don't have the intent to harm, the intentional idea to harm a person when they're doing something, then to them, it is not racist. And if you live by that confined definition of racism, then I guess you can say that America is not a racist country. Maybe.
Well, let's get into that, because all of that, the predicate of that, then maybe you could say it's not a racist country. But before I do that, Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, was asked a few days later, I guess, in response to that, is America a racist country? And I felt she was kind of on the spot, because you're the vice president, you're the first, you know, Black Vice President of the United States, and your response, or was going to record that response and then play it back. And she just said no, which I felt like she could have said more. She could have qualified. She didn't have to qualify the no or the yes. She could have responded in a different way. If you had been her, how would you have responded?
First, I would have said that the fact that you're asking me this question is kind of racist. First of all, like, to ask me a question that is just something that another Black guy said is weird, you know? Like, you're a Black lady, so how do you feel about what another Black guy said? That's a weird thing in itself.
And I hadn't thought of it that way. But that's why you're here. Okay, that's really funny. Go ahead.
And I probably would have answered it in the same way that I just said, right? Like, if you have this narrow definition of racism, then maybe you can think that America is not a racist country. Now, you, the person asking me this question, are asking me that question probably with that narrow definition. So to you, America is probably not a racist country.
Okay. See, that to me is both. That would have been very diplomatic for her and also helpful for people, right? And that would have gotten coverage.
Right. I think it would have, too. You know, I would have, you know, maybe given an allegory of something like, I don't like, I don't know, chocolate, for instance, right? But I know that most of the people in the country do like chocolate. So if you ask me if chocolate is a disgusting thing, a disgusting food, I would say no. I think it's a disgusting thing. But as a representative of the United States of chocolate eaters, I am giving an answer that for this organization that I represent, chocolate is not a disgusting thing.
I think that, now answer it not as you're, as if you're her and you've been asked it, but here's the thing. I mean, because I have, okay, for example, in the debates, Trump and Biden, I think it was in the debates, Trump was asked, is there systemic racism in this country? Or at least it came, that term became an issue. And he would say no. And when I thought about it, I'd say, really? Okay. And I wanted to ask this question. When did it end then?
Right.
When did systemic racism end? What year? Was it 1964, the Civil Rights Bill? Well, no, because the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Was that it? When, what are you talking about? When, what can we get a little bit deeper than no?
Right. You know, or, you know, you could say, well, for 72% of the percent of this country's life from 1776 until the 1965 Voting Rights Act or the 1964 Civil Rights Act, this country lived under slavery or Jim Crow. So it was a racist country for 72% of the time. Now, let's say America was a person and that person had killed someone. Would you say that person was a murderer? Even if he'd served his time and had gotten out of jail, is that person a murderer? Yes, because, you know, it doesn't mean that necessarily that he is going to murder someone, but it means that he is, like, the things that he has done is a murderer. And that's kind of how racism it is. It doesn't matter the intent.
In fairness, the question was, is it systemically racist?
So
systemically racism, and there's no question,
right,
that has been. And you, that's funny that you accepted my 65 Voting Rights Act, which, right, is so, kind of ridiculous.
So if you're asking, is it a racist country, right? So, or is it systemically racist?
Or is it systemically racist?
That's, I would ask,
yeah,
to, for the person who asked that question, to name an institution in America that doesn't have racial disparities. Let's, because we're going to argue and go back and forth all day about what racism is and how you define racism, right? So if you talk about the criminal justice system.
Well, there's no question.
So how about the financial system, right? So how about the political system? Do Black people have access to the polls that white people have? So how about, you know, take any institution in America.
The military. Right. Let's talk about the armed, right, services. I think that's the most, and I was really, you know, taken with the fact that there are a number of white military people who were involved in January 6th, who were involved in that. Because my observation, and this is just from doing a lot of USO tours, I did 7 of them, so it's not really, but it seemed like the most integrated, the most functionally not racist organization I've seen.
Right. And that is also true. So two things can be true at the same time. And I think one of the things that we have to dismiss is the notion that being around Black people or being in an organization that is integrated and diverse somehow dismisses or wipes out racism. Because if it is in every fabric of our society and every institution in our society, just by the fact that this one population of people in America is more diverse than the other populations doesn't mean that it is fenced off from the rest of American society.
Of course not. Right? Of course not. And if you look at any law firm, right? If you look any investment banking, Heather McGee in her book, The Sum of Us, brings up a perfect example for me, which is that if, you know, they've done research on this, and if you apply for a job and your name is Demetrius, you get called back for an interview less than, you know, Steve or Andy.
Right, right. And it's, which is, Sum of Us is a great book, and I've talked to Heather McGee about it. But, you know, my only qualm with the book is that I wish that I had written it.
It's a beautiful book.
It is. It is. The way she makes it personal, the way she explains things as an economist, and my background is as an economist also. And this is one of the things that I used to teach a class called Race as an Economic Construct that used the principles of economics to teach race and the history of racism in America. And so I'm just jealous of Heather McGee's book. That's it.
You see this. Okay. So that's just getting jobs, right? You know, that's, and you still see that we're changing in many cases for the better. There are elite schools that are going like, holy crap, we really, we just had white people here and we got to change that, right? So some people are beginning to get some enlightenment, I think.
I think so, too. I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, as I said before, like we're moving in the right direction, but I think that can also mean that we're not in the place that we want to be, right? The, even when we talk about the founders, they acknowledge that it's a, you know, we want to make a more perfect union. So to say that America is racist is not anti-American. It is actually acknowledging the thought of the founders that we got to keep creating this thing that is more perfect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to me, I would say if you had asked me, like, after Tim Scott said, you know, America is not a racist country, my response to that would be, yeah, we're pretty racist. I mean, that would be my response. It'd be, I don't know how you're defining that, but, you know, if you're talking about where do kids get their K through 12 education? Yeah. Right. That's about economics. And the economics of that is if you go to elementary school and high school in a predominantly black neighborhood in urban America, you probably don't have the same high school, same experience as maybe someone in a very wealthy suburb. Right.
Right. And as an economist and as just as a person who lived in America, I'm often careful to point that out. That, like, when we bring up those statistics, a lot of people assume that, okay, we're talking about a small percentage of black kids who go to this segregated schools or unequal schools. And I have to point out that 60% of non-white children go to schools that are majority black, right? So it's most black people, most Hispanic people go to schools that are not as good as white schools. White schools get on average $2,666 per student more than a predominantly black or Latino school district.
And that's what we're talking about when you're saying they go to a predominantly black school. You're talking about funding.
Right, right.
And you're also talking about the legacy of, look, the chances are that your parents went to graduate school, if you're in a school that's 60% black, is lower than if you're in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Right.
It just is. And, you know, I remember, you know, I was putting my grandson to bed. I was very fortunate during COVID to be sort of in the bubble with my two of my grandkids. And we're reading a book. He's 7 years old, and it has it's a Dr. Seuss book, and it has the drawings of the organs. And he says to me, Grandpa, I'd have to assume that there's some kind of tube between the kidneys and the bladder. And I went, all I could think of is, oh, both his parents went to graduate school. Right. and there is some data which is that a kid whose parents went to graduate school will hear 3 million more words by the time they're five than a kid whose parents didn't go to college. And that is an unbelievable advantage. And that has to do with legacy going way back.
Right. It does. It has to do with, first of all, you know, most of those schools, those graduate schools, those colleges, we couldn't go to until after I was born. Right. After you and I were born. Right. So
as it is, we had Paul Tough on, who's written about sort of the elite schools. And there's still, it's still way biased toward alums, toward people can afford SAT tutors. I mean, you just look at who is going to those schools, which, you know, these schools like Princeton and Harvard, they have endowments where if you can't afford to go, boom, you get the full boat.
Right.
So that on that score, they're great. But you look at who their students are, and there's a difference between, say, Black, Latino, and, say, Asian.
Yeah, and I've written about this, and I write about it from the economic standpoint. So if you look at this, so there's a great study that came out, I think, in 2019 that measures what they call ALDC. So there's four different ways that people kind of get exceptions into getting into Harvard. This one specifically looked at Harvard, right? So if you are a child of a person who works at Harvard, you can get an exception. If you are an athlete, you can get an exception.
Well, it's not an exception. It means that you're held to slightly,
right,
not exactly the same high SATs or
right,
that kind of thing, right?
And it what happens is we think, well, those exceptions go to my Black and minority students, when actually they don't. The vast majority of people at elite schools who get, for instance, athletic scholarships are white, right? We think of the football and the basketball team and forget about the lacrosse team and the soccer team and the crew team and the golf team and the tennis team, who that's disproportionately white. And then, you know, the staff and the professors are disproportionately white, and the people who gave big donations, who also get an exception, are disproportionately white. And so what you have is a small group of Black people and Latino people and Asian people who got in on what white people call affirmative action. But those students are still among the highest performers in their school districts, at their schools. And you got a bunch of mediocre white kids who just got in because they knew somebody. And what happens is the excellence of those Asian and Black and Latino students, they supplement the school's reputation for the white kids who just knew somebody. So it's not that just that those schools are disproportionately white, is that those white students who graduate get the benefit from having the smartest Black and Latino and Asian kids attend the school, because those students worked harder and the white students just knew somebody.
Well, you know, it depends exactly what we're talking about. It's hard to get into Harvard if you're anybody.
Right.
I mean, legacies it helps.
Yes.
Those kids, it's crazy now.
Right.
It's crazy hard. And they could take an entire class of just kids who got 800s on,
right,
on all their SATs.
And the other thing I often point out is, like,
you're thinking more of like Trinity.
Right. So, and the other thing I also often talk about is, like, if you're going, like, I think there's a misunderstanding of how affirmative action in those schools work. Any school, not just the most elite ones, and that they think that if a Black kid got in, they got in because they didn't achieve in high school. And what it is, let's say it's the University of Texas, which is a great case, is the Amy Fisher case. If the standard SAT score that for students is a 1200, the Black kids still got 1200 on their SATs. It's just that they didn't compete against the white students who got the 1300, right? But if you look at it holistically, a black kid who attended an underfunded school with what statistics say had smaller libraries, teachers use fewer words, they have fewer resources, and they got a little bit less, but still above the standard of the school, but they got a little bit less than the white kid who got SAT tutors, who went to the best schools, whose parents went to graduate school. They kind of, even though the SAT score might be a little less, they kind of achieved more, right?
Absolutely. Let me give you, I mentioned Paul Tough's book, and he was a guest on this podcast, and it's a really interesting book and interview. But they did a thing. What they did was, and I mentioned Trinity because of this. So one year they got a new admissions director who had gone to an inner city school and did not get into a great college, but then graduate school, got into like Berkeley, and then got his PhD at Harvard. Now he's, and he said, we're not going to have SATs and ACTs. We're just not going to have them. We're going to do that blind. And so as a result, he picked a different class. Now they still, because Trinity doesn't have the kind of endowment that Princeton and Harvard does, they still had to take some kids because of money.
Right.
They needed the money. But so they get this class, and because of that, U.S. News and World Report, because they don't have the SATs to judge by, they lower their ranking. So they go from like 34th in the U.S. News and World Report ranking to 43rd, okay? And so now the trustees at Trinity are freaking out, because basically college admissions directors at high schools now tell you, apply to a crap load of schools. There's a uniform,
application.
Application. Mm-hmm. And then go to the one that's highest ranked on the U.S. News and World Report. And then you're continually ranked as a school by how low a percent kids you admit. So now the trustees are freaking out. The faculty wrote the trustees and said, please don't change this. This class is so much better. These kids are so creative. These kids are so smart. These don't do it. And of course, it was a much more racially diverse class. And yeah, you're right. Yeah, a kid can get SAT training up the wazoo and raise his scores by 200 points. Big friggin' deal.
Right. So it's, and I know this is going, it's deep theoretical stuff, but it's the thing that theoretical physicists and call, like, when we believe that the measuring of a thing affects the thing.
Heisenberg.
Right.
That's the Heisenberg principle.
Right. So because we know the S.
I did well on my SATs. Yeah,
the SAT. The SAT doesn't really measure anything except your parents' wealth and how good of a school you went to. But when we use it to rank these schools, then it perpetuates that same disparity in ranking, right? So the more racially diverse college classes, they get ranked lower because they didn't perform as well on the SAT, which is already biased, right? So this is some of the things that we're talking about when we go back to the original question of, is America a racist country? I remember once I was working like at a place that built boats in my hometown, right? It was, and I just happened to have conversation with the guy who owned it. And he asked me, why was this there a perception in our town that his company was racist? And so I was raised in a town where there were two high schools, a black high school and a white high school. And they were basically just, of course, remnants of segregation, and they were neighborhood schools. And so the white high school had a career academy that was partially funded by his company. And if you worked in his career track at that company, you would almost automatically get a job at this boat company. The black school didn't have it. So his intention might not have been to give white kids a better chance to get employed at his company. But the result was that he had a racial disparity because white kids had a better chance to get hired at his company. And it doesn't. And my point is that it sometimes the intention doesn't matter. The outcome matters because it is impossible to measure what someone has in their heart. It is the how their feelings and how their actions manifest themselves in the real world in relation to others that determines whether something is racist or not.
Now, when you said that to the guy, they go, oh, and then he just go, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Or, yeah. Okay, good. Did he open a little, did he open the same program?
Yeah. So he
at the black school.
So what he did is he halved his funding between the two schools. And now not only is it one of the most diverse companies in the area, but it jumped up in the standings on boat manufacturers. Now his boats are considered better because he's just had a more diverse group of employees. In other words,
oh man, Michael, you made a difference.
So in other words, so when you have one group of people who all learn the same thing trying to figure out a problem, they're all going to come up with the same answer. But when you have a bunch of different people attacking that problem from different perspectives, they get a bunch of solutions and then they can choose the best solution. And that's why diversity matters, not for some egalitarian principle of, oh, well, let's just be not racist because it's better for society. It actually works. It makes the thing that you're making better.
Well, this is what Heather's book was about, which is basically that white people are sold that anything that's good for black people takes away from them.
Right. The zero-sum principle. Game.
Yeah. And the fact is that we all do better when we all do better. And that's exactly that boat company.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back with Michael Harriott.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, we're back with Michael Harriott, senior writer for TheRoot.com. So there's a couple of things I wanted to ask you. You wrote a terrific article about the Tulsa massacre or the black massacre in Tulsa a century ago. I wanted to ask you about that and about why really did we just hear about this or most Americans just hear about, really? Oh, wow, that's bad. Whoa, I didn't know that. And then the other ones, there must be, there's other. And also we massacred Indians in Minnesota. I wasn't, my family was in Krakow. I mean, we were in Europe. And that's why we shouldn't pay reparations. That's my, and I want to get to that. I want to get to reparations and sort of this idea that if you were in Krakow until, or in Belarus, or wherever your family was from until 1902, well, then I had nothing to do with slavery. And I didn't benefit at all from racism since 1902 because I'm white and didn't have any advantages. And so I shouldn't pay any reparations. But I tell you who should. People own slaves who you can prove own slaves. I want to talk about that, too.
Right. So I guess we could start with Tulsa, right?
Either way.
And these massacres and kind of tie them together, right? So Tulsa is definitely not the worst one or the only one.
Wow. It isn't the worst
one? No. In 1920, the Thibodaux massacre was probably the worst one. But again, we're still discovering a lot of these massacres. So Thibodaux was a, this was after the Civil War. It was sugarcane plantation in Thibodaux, Louisiana, right? So the black workers, mostly black workers who worked on these sugar plantations were trying to organize a union. And, you know, of course, the plantation owners who had just come out of slavery were against it. So at a meeting for black organizers, the paramilitary forces of what we would call Klansmen now, they had a bunch of different names in Louisiana, the White League, the League of the White Camellia. Well, they attacked these workers, and we kind of still don't know how many were killed because they killed, you know, the people weren't just from one town. So it wasn't like Tulsa in that, you know, they burned a section of town. They just killed people. And then once the word got out in newspapers, more white supremacist groups started coming down and just started hunting people for like a week. So it was one of the biggest black massacres in history. And so it lasted for the, I mean, it went through the entire county. Some people say 300, some people say as many as 1,000 were killed. The bodies were burned and buried in shallow graves. So we don't know how many people really died. And there are stories like this all over the country. Oscarville in Georgia, right outside of Atlanta, is one of my favorites. Well, not favorite, but is one of the craziest stories because, so there's a lake called Lake Lanier that has a bunch of resorts around it in Georgia. And every summer, a bunch of white people die drowning in that lake. And the legend is that there are the ghosts of black people who are enacting their revenge because years ago, Oscarville, Georgia was a majority black town. They had this motor speedway, a bunch of black businesses, kind of like Tulsa. And black man was accused of raping a white woman. Her grandchildren say it was definitely a false accusation. And they slaughtered the black people and ran the rest of them out of town. And then a couple of years later, they came up with this idea to flood this black town by building a dam and providing Atlanta with hydroelectric power. So they basically flooded the town. And so under the town is still this intact entire black city. And sometimes when there's a drought, you can see like the tops of smokestacks and the motor speedway peek up from the lake.
Boy, that's eerie.
Right. And
that is The Shining. That is really, really worth making. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to make a movie.
And it's interesting. There was 57 boating fatalities and 145 drownings between 99 and 2018. So it's like,
well, there you go. That's so the movie.
Like they still go swimming.
That's there. Act
still,
two.
Like, this big resort area, like the 128 boating accidents in the last 3 years alone. You know, there's this kind of legend there. Like if you're black, you know not to go swimming in Lake Lanier because. and so what's funny about it, it's always been this kind of black legend.
Maybe there's like, I would check out who owns the bars around there because maybe there's like a lot of black guys own bars.
Yeah.
Just go, no, have another drink.
Yeah. Yeah. And then right before you go swimming.
And then get in your boat.
Yeah.
Or right before. Or eat up.
Yeah. So. So these kinds of stories like Tulsa, like the Thibodaux Massacre, are kind of well known because black people pass these stories amongst each other. And these are the things that they don't teach in schools, right? And so these kinds of you know, black people are aware of not just these atrocities, but these kind of systemic issues that we were talking about earlier that are pervasive in American history. And that's why a lot of people, black people, support reparations, because we kind of know more than white people about racism in America. And it's also important to point out that black people don't think white people should pay reparations. They think America should pay reparations. So it's not like black people's taxes wouldn't be taken. It's like it's just like the national deficit. All of us are responsible, even though we don't all benefit from the stuff that America did or some of the debts that America owes. And one of the historical things, when we talk about Brown versus Board of Education, for instance, right? And this is one of the things that I'd like to point out about reparations. So let's forget about slavery. Let's take slavery off to the board. It was legal. It was constitutional. The Constitution ruled out, made slavery illegal. So let's take slavery off the board. And let's talk about from 1865 until now, right? When black people were working, were paying taxes. And for most of that period, we couldn't attend the same schools. We just talked about how even when we could attend schools, black schools were underfunded. So we were, in essence, paying to educate white children, to make America better for white people. When you talk about the New Deal, that came out of Americans' taxes after black people were freed from slavery. And our money was used to build an entire white middle class.
Yeah, actually, a lot of people don't think about this or realize it, that there were a lot of concessions made to get white Southern votes for the New Deal. Like, who would not get Social Security, right?
Right. Who wouldn't get Social Security? We can go into the history of redlining when, banks were forbidden from giving loans on homes that weren't in white neighborhoods. And so all of that money, all those black people's taxes went to white people. And so reparations, in a sense, could not just be for slavery, but for the money that black people invested in America and didn't get a return. If America was a stock, we bought those stocks and white people got the dividends. And again, black people aren't asking white people to pay for those, because if you came from Krakow, as you said, in 1902, you still got to attend a good white school in a white neighborhood that may have...
That's why my argument before kind of falls apart.
Right. So every white person benefited from the labor and the taxes of all the black people. And all black people are saying in the reparations argument is that, hey, we don't want something special. We want the things that our parents and our grandparents didn't get, because a lot of the people who are just middle class people now benefited from their grandparents and their parents' labor and from black people's labor, and black people didn't have that opportunity.
Okay, now do you think there's been a lot of writing lately about what happened in 2016 and how when Obama got elected and got reelected, we kind of went like, whoo, it's over. Racism is done. Phew. and then we saw that, oh my goodness, there's a backlash. Wow. And that's Trump. And this country now is just crazy. And the Republican Party has just become mad. Crazy mad. So when will we have a serious discussion? How many decades from now? I mean, we need to start now, we need to have started, and we have. When do we really have a real chance of seriously addressing that?
I think we're starting to address it now. One of the things is that the reparations movement is not new. It started after the Civil War. When we look at the discussions in Congress, the group from which people were selected to address that congressional subcommittee in Cobra was around since the 60s, right? Callie Guy House started the Mutual Benefit Fund, which was trying to give reparations for ex-slaves, what she called pensions for ex-slaves.
No, what year? 1860s?
In the 1860s, right?
Okay.
Until she was jailed for mail fraud, because that's what always happens. So I think we just have to keep talking about it, just as we did with the civil rights movement, right? We didn't start talking about civil rights and then it all of a sudden happened. It snowballed into a thing where it was unignorable, and then we had to do something about it. So I think to keep the conversation going is actually doing something in the hopes that one day we will reach the conclusion that, hey, man, we got to just fix these wealth disparities in Black and Brown communities.
Yeah, maybe we should take the value of 40 acres and a mule and just compound it with compound interest.
Yeah. It's valuable.
Is that a formula?
So I have a different formula, but that, I mean, my formula is not exclusive. I'm willing to accept whatever formula someone comes up with. But I think like, addressing those disparities, you know, can go. My mother actually, and when I mentioned that place, Monk's Corner, so there are people in the surrounding areas of Charleston who actually got their 40 acres and a mule and kind of still live on them. My mother lives on a 40 acre and a mule plot right now as we're talking.
Has it been subdivided?
Well, it's been subdivided amongst the family, but the entire family, like my sister's husband's entire family, and they, you know, you build a house here. And so some of those places still exist.
Must be nice.
Yeah, it is.
That's what we say in Minnesota, by the way. Right. That's the passive aggressive right. thing you say. Must be nice.
Right. So when I think about that, right, it's not an abstract idea. I don't have to look at, for instance, a white family whose grandmother built the house. And then when they were, you know, 80 years old, they passed it down to their grandchildren, or their parents might have taken out a loan against the house's value to send them to college, and then that child got to get out of college with no debt, right? So those are the things that you can look at to see how this wealth disparity expands throughout generations because of the things that we did years ago. And I can see them specifically because, you know, I have nieces and nephews who like have houses and who are educated, who don't have student loans because they got the benefit of something that happened 150 years ago.
Yep. And of course, in Tulsa, in the, was it the Greenwood section right. of Tulsa? It was called the Black Wall Street and had these businesses that were thriving and was a prosperous community. I think most of my listeners have now heard about the Tulsa Massacre. You wrote a terrific article about it. But that wealth wasn't compounded. That was lost.
Right, right. And Tulsa is an egregious case, but it's also important to point out that Tulsa wasn't the only community like that, right? Tulsa, during the time where it was thriving, was probably the least known of these, what we call Black Wall Streets. There's Black Wall Street in Durham, North Carolina, in the Hayti community of Durham, North Carolina, in Richmond, Virginia, in Boley, Oklahoma. A bunch of them were in Oklahoma just because Oklahoma kind of started as a state where Black people ran to thinking that there was going to be an all-Black state. Some of those weren't dismantled by massacres, but they were all dismantled. Like they drive, like one of the easiest ways to do it, and you see this throughout history, was just to put a freeway or a highway through the Black community.
Right. And, well, we did that, yeah, in Minnesota. Yeah.
And dispossess them of their land. And so, you know, that happened in Richmond. That happened in Durham, in the Hayti district. The Hayti district in Durham was probably the most successful of them. And it was also where the first sit-in took place. So Tulsa was by no means like this extraordinary case. I think Black people know about it because of the egregious massacre. And, you know, it was something that was commonly known among Black people even before, like, you know, years. Like, there's a rapper called The Game whose record label was called Black Wall Street, and nobody ever asked them because like all the Black people knew what it meant. And then We just, you know, America as a whole just kind of start paying attention a couple years ago or this year.
I want to ask you about critical race theory and what's taught in schools and what's being resisted by, you know, the usual suspects.
Right.
And the 1619 curriculum and those things.
Right. So let's start with critical race theory. So there's this misunderstanding. It's always important to point out that the 1619 Project isn't critical race theory. It is a product of critical race theory, just like teaching, like if you have a computer class or a class about, I don't know, Microsoft Word in your school, you're not teaching computer engineering. Critical race theory is a complex thing that produced the 1619 Project, but to teach the 1619 Project is not teaching critical race theory any more than to teach someone how to use Microsoft Word is teaching computer engineering. So critical race theory was founded in the 80s by, you know, the one of the persons who is credited with being the creator is Derrick Bell. So he had this idea. He was teaching a law school, and he had this idea that, hey, if we're going to use the law to dismantle racism, then we have to understand how the law has manifested racism. So if you're looking at, for instance, the Constitution, you have to understand that, you know, a quarter of the people who signed it were slave owners. So if the people who created this country, who created this thing, had racist tendencies, however you want to count slave owning, then it makes sense that this racism manifests itself in the law. And we have to look at that through the lens. If we look at the law through the lens of race, if we look at America through the lens of race, if we look at history through the lens of race, then we will see how we got to be where we are today. So in American schools, we learn history through the lens of whiteness. And this is something that I didn't realize until a couple of years ago, because I was homeschooled until I was 13 years old. And so I learned history just in my mama's house. And so I only had a revelation a couple years ago when I realized that, oh, so we learn about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and the noble founders. And then like years later, we learn about slavery and racism and Jim Crow. And so it's hard to reconcile those two things, these noble founders and this idea of racism being pervasive, if the foundation is built on the idea that these guys are good guys, right? So what the 1619 Project would say is that America at its beginning was almost a failure until slaves showed up. Right, until they got free labor. And there's no other way to explain it, how America became an economic superpower so fast, right? Other than they had 4 million people working for free, right? So if you explain America that way, then you don't necessarily hate America, you just see it from an objective perspective, right? You don't say, well, these people, George Washington hated black people. Nah, but you understand that, oh, I understand why he was protecting this institution that we now consider racist, because it was a way to build this country into an economic superpower. And slavery at the root was white supremacist, because white people were the only ones who got the benefit of it. And so people have conflated the 1619 with critical race theory, I think, because it just has the word race in it. But no teacher is teaching this complex legal and social theory to sixth graders, because it's just too hard to understand, right?
Right.
But it's easy for, you know, Ron DeSantis to stand in front of a bunch of white people or to go on Fox News and say, critical race theory is teaching your kids to hate America. Now, it is possible that if you know the real roots of racism and you know how racism has manifested itself throughout American history, you might say this country's kind of racist, right? That might be a byproduct of just learning the truth, right? Like if you have been bitten by a dog, or if you know, hey, this dog has bitten 17 people before I reached out my hand to pet it, you might be like, oh, man, this dog is kind of crazy.
So the 1619 Project, or the curriculum, is just teaching our history.
Like, is this teaching our history? Now, a lot of people object to the perception that, well, you know, the premise of the 1619 Project was like for Black people, that's important to remember, that America began in 1619. Well, if you go into a regular history class, we teach American history from the point where white people showed up. So ask a Native American if the regular history of America is racist or teaches you how to hate Native Americans, because it starts with when white people showed up, right? And that is the point, right? A perspective in history that we've always been taught has been the white perspective. And to say that the 1619 Project is racist is to also say that all of the other history views are racist, because they only start from when white people showed up.
Yeah, well, usually, you know, people say America began in 1776.
Right.
But actually, if you're taking that tack, it would have begun in 1783. Is that right?
Well, it depends on, again.
It depends on the Constitution. I don't know.
Yeah.
We did have the colonies. We did have, and we had slavery for a long time.
Yeah.
Long, long time. Well, thank you, Michael. Keep up the great work. Everybody should be reading The Root. You'll learn a lot, and you'll have a good time. That's a lot of kids write that from camp. I've learned a lot, and I've had a good time, Mom and Dad. But you will if you read The Root and Michael Harriet. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fuse,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.